The Pan American Exposition in Buffalo, New York, meant to herald the 20th century, went tragically, spectacularly awry. A topic addressed in historian Margaret Creighton's new book, The Electrifying Fall of Rainbow City, Spectacle and Assassination at the 1901 World's Fair. In 1901, Buffalo was the eighth largest city in the United States, and its leaders had big dreams. They would host a World's Fair showcasing the Americas and bring millions of people to Western New York. The exposition opened with fanfare. Its wonders, both strange and magnificent, dazzled the public. Then tragedy struck. In the early autumn of 1901, an assassin stalked the fairgrounds waiting for President William McKinley. That was shocking enough, but there were more surprises in store. Margaret Creighton is a professor of history at Bates College and lives in Maine. Again, the name of the new book is The Electrifying Fall of Rainbow City, and we welcome Margaret Creighton to the roundtable this morning. Margaret, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, I'm delighted to be here.
What brought you to this particular subject?
Strangely enough, I grew up maybe less than a quarter of a mile from the old Pan American Exposition grounds in Buffalo. And I say strangely because the event, while growing up, never really made much of an impression on me. The fairgrounds, with the exception of one building and a small lake, had long been made over into streets and fancy homes and so forth. And maybe it was the fact that the assassination kind of cast a gloom over the memory, but it really wasn't something that we were taught in class or we went to, you know, exhibits to think about. It had really pretty much disappeared from the city history. So it is something that I didn't think much about until I was living in New England, as I have been, and teaching a class on 19th century and early 20th century American history, and I assigned Eric Larson's wonderful Devil in the White City about the Chicago 1893 fair. And it occurred to me that Buffalo had a fair that it wanted to be a sequel to the Chicago Fair. 1901, Buffalo had great ambitions that it would, in fact, attract even more people than Chicago had. It had a better railroad connection. It had Niagara Falls nearby. It was going to be a tremendous success. And I returned to Buffalo, visiting old friends and family, and began to dig around and realized there was a lot more to the story of the fair than the assassination, and a lot to the story of why the fair effectively didn't match Chicago, and it became kind of a, well, not a tragic sequel, but certainly a problematic one.
Talk a little bit about World's Fairs in general and why places like Buffalo wanted them and what the hope was that it would bring to the city and the region.
Well, at the time, World's Fairs, I mean, and you almost had one, some even twice a year, at least every other year at the turn of the 20th century. And these were great opportunities for cities to bring in business, to kind of raise their national profile. And Buffalo itself dreamed of being a greater urban area, perhaps even catching up to Chicago, perhaps even getting closer to the numbers of New York. And Buffalo, at the turn of the 20th century, was in the big league. It was the eighth biggest city in the country, the biggest inland port in the world. It boasted state-of-the-art architecture, a fantastic Olmsted Park, a fancy French cemetery. It had brand new asphalted streets, electric lights and streetcars powered by Niagara Falls, and it even boasted about the weather, if you can believe that. The lake effect at the time meant cooling breezes in the summer as opposed to what we now think of as the lake effect, which is, you know, 10 feet of snow.
In looking at the subtitle of the book, Spectacle and Assassination at the 1901 World's Fair, let's talk about the spectacle aspect first of what they had. You alluded to this earlier, of what they had, of what they were hoping would bring people in and work to their advantage.
Well, one of the things that they had that they really celebrated was electric power. And you know, one of the things they wanted to talk about was the triumph over the natural world, and in this case meant subjugating Niagara Falls for electric technology, for powering an amazing light show in the evening of the fair, something called the Illumination that brought in tons and tons of people and even drew accolades from individuals like Tesla and Edison. So this was going to be a real signature moment for the supremacy of American technology and for Buffalo to represent being on the progressive vanguard of this technology.
At what point in the planning of this, because there really is the duality of Buffalo and Niagara Falls, correct?
Right. So yeah, they thought that they would work on this, that it would be a kind of companion attraction. Absolutely.
And that was the idea, to bring both of these together.
Right. And oddly enough, and it was a Pan-American fair, it was going to celebrate the progress of the Western Hemisphere. And so old world countries were not going to be invited to give fancy displays or to put up big exhibit halls. This is going to be a Western Hemisphere affair. And strangely enough, the country of Canada, which was, of course, seemed like 20 feet away, had a presence at the fair, but it wasn't a major attraction. And I think this was all about developing commercial ties and advancing trade with Latin American republics. So it was, part of this grand scheme to celebrate the United States and its power in the Western Hemisphere.
So let us talk then about the assassination part, and that is looking at President McKinley's visit to the World's Fair. What was his plan for that day, and what was on the schedule? What was supposed to happen?
Well, what was supposed to happen, that it was, in fact, what did happen in the morning was that he was going to visit Niagara Falls, look at some power stations, have a lovely lunch, and then return to the fairgrounds for a reception at the Temple of Music. And his wife had been with him all morning, and she returned to the Milburn House where he was staying to freshen up. She had been ill rather recently. And so he went on to the Temple of Music alone with fair dignitaries and a fairly impressive security force, and shook hands with people who had come to the Temple of Music to meet and greet the president. And it was in that setting, in the afternoon, that he was shot by Leon Czolgosz, who was a laborer from Ohio who had been in the environs of Buffalo for a month or so at least, and who had effectively been stalking the president for about a couple of days.
You talk about one of the great ironies that for a place that was so focused on illumination and looking at light, that actually a lack of light in the surgery that followed added, there are many questions as to the death and whether it had to happen, because he was brought to a place with not much light. Roswell Park was not used. So there are many things that were questioned as to why they were not in place that perhaps contributed to the death of the president.
Well, the fact that they couldn't find a decent light bulb in the operating room on the grounds of the exposition, it's a great story.
Yes.
They eventually found one, but it couldn't, it barely lit what we know as a Christmas tree. I mean, it was just a pitiful little effort. But I think that there was really very little anybody could do to save a man whose pancreas had effectively been torn up. One of the things I did was talk to a variety of trauma surgeons now to ask them whether or not they thought that the president could have been saved. And they said it would have been very, very difficult with the lack of imaging, with the lack of antibiotics, and so forth. It's even a challenge now. So it was a remote possibility, you could say, but very, very difficult. And I think the hard thing was that he, you know, lingered so long, so that you had this great exhale from on the part of Buffalo, you know, that it had been the site of this heinous act, and now Buffalo could claim that it had done what very few other places had done, that it had actually rescued and saved the president. And there was talk of Buffalo hosting the cabinet, of the Milburn House becoming the a temporary White House for a while. And Buffalo was applauded for the expertise of its physicians, and it was just a moment after such a dire event, a moment of great exhilaration. And one of the, you know, I think the real tragedy is in the city's realization, you know, after 8 days, that this, in fact, was the nightmare that they had, you know, thought they'd avoided.
And you write in the book that Roswell Park did not actually agree with the treatment that he witnessed at the hospital, and years later would say that he saw things that really bothered him.
Yes, I mean, he in hindsight, he had some things to say about his fellow medical practitioners, including the fact that one of the people operating on the president was sweating and dripped a few drops of perspiration into the open wound. This really bothered Roswell Park and, of course, makes a great story.
What does it do, as you say, a lot of this story has to do with legacy, doesn't it? I mean, as far
right.
as what they had hoped the legacy would be and what the legacy actually became.
Right, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the things that Buffalo, which, and it's now, the city is now actually speaking of the assassination of McKinley, or at least other people around the country are talking of this as kind of a curse equivalent to the curse of the Bambino with the Boston Red Sox, you know, that this is the curse that doesn't allow the Bills to prevail and so forth. But there's a lot that Buffalo could be proud of or could talk about with regard to this exposition. First of all, it did give countries, Latin American republics, a platform on which to speak and address American audiences and tell them about what their country's ambitions were and to really talk back to the United States. This is particularly the case with Cuba. And of course, Cuba, the United States had its heavy hand in Cuba at this time. But Cuba got on stage at the exposition and said, look, you know, we really want you out of our country. We want to be fully free. And so one of the things that the exposition did was to give a platform to these countries that really had not seen much effective representation in other world's fairs at the time. So there are ways that Buffalo can look back and be proud of some of the effort. Certainly the technology, the use of electricity was apparently just beautiful, awe-inspiring. So they can look at, back at that, and they can also talk about the ways that the power struggles that emerged in the fair really helped predict some of the power struggles that we see or we saw ongoing in the 20th century and that we still see very much today.
Margaret Creighton is the author of the book, The Electrifying Fall of Rainbow City. The book is published by Norton. Margaret, thank you very much for spending time with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Well, thanks very much. I enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, The Electrifying Fall of Rainbow City, Spectacle and Assassination in the 1901 World's Fair. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.